Hi, this is John Udell, and in today's podcast, I speak with Jeff Nielsen, Chief Scientist of Digital Focus, a company that specializes in the practice and teaching of agile software development. Jeff spoke to me from XP 2005, the International Conference on Extreme Programming and Agile Processes in Software Engineering. The principles of agile software development are set forth in a manifesto at agilemanifesto.org, and they're briefly stated. We value, it says, individuals and interactions over processes and tools, working software over comprehensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation, and responding to change over following a plan. That might sound kind of abstract, but we'll hear from Jeff how these principles play out in practice with customers such as Fannie Mae and the Federal Home Loan Bank. Jeff, you're at the XP 2005 conference right now?
Is that right? That's what I'm doing in England.
Yeah, okay. How's that going?
Oh, it's great. I love these conferences because it's a chance to sort of get re-energized. You know, there's always a couple of ideas or you know, conversations you end up having. You can't really predict when you're going to have that moment that sort of re-energizes you, but there's always, you know, one or two moments. Well, this is the fifth or sixth, I'm going to get my number wrong, version of the XP conference. The original one was back in 2000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And back then it was all about sort of defining what XP is, and now everyone's heard of XP and agile methodologies, and it's more of the devil's in the details kind of thing. How do we, you know, there's a panel today on how do we change our, you know, higher education to do a better job of teaching XP and agile methodologies. There's, you know, lots of sessions on, well, how have people really been successful with automated acceptance testing.
So what was the upshot of the how do we teach the stuff panel?
Oh, I didn't go to that session.
Oh, you didn't.
My
okay.
colleague did.
Okay.
Haven't debriefed with him yet.
Okay.
I was at the one of the concurrent sessions.
And you're giving a talk there as well?
Yeah, we actually gave a talk this morning up on the experience we had helping a large financial services organization adopt XP over a period of about 2.5 years.
So when do you tell me about that?
I would love to. This is one of those looking back kind of things. The end result was that they've got one of their three main divisions, the IT organization, is largely converted, if you want to use that word, or has adopted a version of XP for all of their internal work and are very happy with it. How they got there is really the interesting story. What we found is particularly with larger organizations, someone inside the organization's gotta take the risk to say, you know, I think this is worth trying and I'll stand up and be the champion of this process. And what we found is that in a, you know, larger organization that people aren't willing to do that unless they've got some sort of proof that XP or Agile methodologies will work in their particular context.
Well, some of that proof, I would imagine, is just observing what's coming up from the grassroots, right? I mean, it's, you know, one of the opportunities here is for individual developers on their own initiative to begin doing certain things, like practicing test-driven development, really of their own initiative and on their own time, if you will, right?
Sure.
And that, you know, at least my observation is that people have started to see a fair amount of that stuff coming up from the bottom.
And that is true. There has been a lot of this bottoms-up grassroots sort of thing. What happens is, at least in our experience, is you run into that can only take you so far. You know, first of all, Agile isn't just about changing the behavior of the programmers. It's also about changing the behavior of the buyers and the specifiers of the system,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, involves in the organizations we typically work with that have, you know, it's some, like Fannie Mae, they have their own internal IT, but that's, IT isn't really Fannie Mae's business. It's the lending and the mortgages. So if you don't, you know, the developers can certainly, like you said, say, well, our team, we're gonna, you know, do continuous integration and have automated builds and you know, implement all our code using test-driven development. But if your business counterpart isn't prepared to talk and plan and budget in terms of stories and iterations and quarterly releases, you can only take that so far. And those seem to be the, it doesn't seem to be necessarily the developer practices, that people are hesitant to adopt wholesale. It's the more visible, you know, changing where people sit and changing the way we report status and changing the way people are recognized by, you know, HR and all those sorts of things, where you've really got to that's the right metaphor, stick your neck out.
Well, I guess you're raising the larger question here of how what is ultimately a service-oriented business, if we want to bring in that buzzword,
right,
is itself beginning to do at the business layer the equivalent of continuous integration and iterative refinement.
Yeah, well, and even the more basic question of most people have the wrong model for how software gets built. This phase-based approach that, you know, phase-based or waterfall approach is really ingrained not only in our educational program, but also in the way IT organizations are structured. And so people have been trained to believe that the only safe, you know, responsible way to build software is with a requirements phase and then an analysis phase and then a development phase and then a testing phase. And to suggest that there could be a whole different way to go about attacking a large software project is really, you have to change a lot of people's mental model.
Well, but isn't it being changed for them at the same time by the environment around them and the evolutions that we see happening, such that, I mean, increasingly people find themselves embedded in these business partner relationships, which also happen to be software service partnership relationships. The composition of services in the business layer and the composition of services in the IT layer are kind of becoming the same thing. So, I mean, that's I would think, kind of driving, you know, if you will, from the top down, the realization that the waterfall model is history.
Well, you're right in the sense that at least what we've seen is that once you tell business that there's a way to get that they don't have to wait a year to see their software that's been developed for the year. You know, that you can think in terms of weeks and quarters. And expect to see value from your software investment, you know, within a quarter, and expect to be able to change your mind. Like, I think that's where like you say, they're being forced into a different way of thinking because the old way just doesn't support what the business needs to do anymore. The problem is people still think, you know, if you've never experienced a different approach, then you just sort of accept as a fact of life, well, I get one sort of shot to, you know, specify my requirements for the year or even for the 6-month period, and then I got to just cross my fingers, hold my breath, and see what comes out at the other end. If you haven't been exposed at least to the idea that, you know, teams can, you know, produce an incrementally bigger and better system every week, that's a powerful idea and a powerful, like I say, a mental shift.
Right. So, I mean, what's your role in all of this then? What do you guys try to do?
We do two things. One is we do custom software development, and we've been doing that since our inception. And since 2000, we have been doing that using XP Agile techniques. In a natural evolution from that approach was having clients come to us saying, you know, I love working with you guys. I love the way you work. We can't afford you for all of our, we can't outsource everything to you. Is there any way you could come teach our IT folks how to do what you do, essentially? And so, that's what happened with Fannie Mae back in, you know, we did a couple of outsource projects for them in 2000, 2001, 2002, and then 2003 rolled along. They said, hey, you know, any way you'd consider coming and training our folks. And so we went on site, a couple of us to first run some projects and then later coach some projects. Mm-hmm. And we're successful enough with that at Fannie Mae and a couple of other places, including America Online, that we decided to launch a formal service offering, for doing agile consulting. So we have a practice area now that's dedicated strictly to helping other organizations, do agile adoption, learn about agile methodologies and adopt them successfully.
Okay. So to somebody like me who is inherently suspicious of the word methodology, what does this in practice boil down to?
That's a great question. What we really try to do when we go into an organization isn't implement XP per se or implement Scrum per se. We do use some of the practices that we found very successful, you know, test first programming, teaching refactoring, having people sit together, using story-based planning. But our hope really is that as an organization sees how these, tries to figure out how these practices fit into their context, that what happens is really a larger shift in like I said, in thinking about the way, thinking about the task of software development. So our goal with going into an organization is for them to come out with their own customized version of an approach, a methodology that you could call agile. So we don't say that we helped Fannie Mae do XP. We say we helped Fannie Mae implement their own version of an agile methodology that really fits within their regulatory requirements and other constraints.
So what does their version of it end up looking like?
It's a good question. It's easier to talk about some of the differences, I guess, between textbook XP and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things they do each iteration is the incremental documentation, which involves updating user manuals and updating the use cases that live as part of the as part of the system documentation. They also tack on a small acceptance testing phase at the end, after all the iterations are complete prior to any given release. Although they've shortened their releases from being one, you know, maybe one release a year to a release at least every 3 months, they still tack on this little acceptance testing phase, which they, even though sort of they've shortened it, they can't get rid of it completely. So those aren't the best examples. I'm grasping for a...
Well, for example, one thing I'd be curious about is,
yeah.
I'm aware of, well, Ward Cunningham, and his fit idea.
Right.
It's something I've thought a lot about over the last year or two.
Uh-huh.
The notion that you ultimately want the business use cases, you know, the scenarios that drive the design and development of the software to themselves be directly testable in some sense, right?
Yes.
You want to generate,
You want the same document to be both the specification and the test.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, is there any evidence in what they're doing or in other examples from your practice of this kind of thing becoming a reality?
Fannie Mae is actually not, they do have automated acceptance testing. It's not to the level of like a fit test. It's still a separate. The tests are written out textually, and then they're implemented in a different tool. We do have another client we're working with, Federal Home Loan Bank, that has embraced fit and fitness, and is doing sort of in my view at least achieving that vision.
What does FIT stand for? I forget, by the way.
Excuse me.
What does FIT stand for?
FIT is Framework for Integrated Testing.
Okay, right.
And then Fitness is a wiki that is built on top of FIT.
Mm-hmm.
Which gives you a fit, as you know, takes HTML as input,
mm-hmm.
and produces HTML as output. So fitness allows you to just do all that sort of easily on a wiki.
Right.
And what we've seen happen at FHLB is, for the first time, at least in my career, tests that can be read and validated by the non-technical people because they're written as part of just the requirements document with the tables interspersed. So that the documents read very much like, here's two bullets that are the requirements, here's a couple of tables worth of examples, and the examples are what become the tests. And they not only have their testers and users responded very positively to that, but they're also their auditing group came in and saw a little demo of how we were using fitness for the acceptance testing and we're ecstatic. They said we much prefer this to traceability matrices or anything else.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fabulous idea, and I've just been curious to see some live examples. So
yeah,
maybe you can tell me a little bit more about what that one is.
Okay, well, let me talk you through how a typical story gets from inception to completion.
Mm-hmm.
They've organized all the work into stories. So for any given, they're using 2-week iterations, and for any given iteration, there's half a dozen user stories. On the first, each story starts out by being a separate wiki page or a separate HTML page in fitness. And initially, for the first day of the iteration, that page will contain, you know, couple lines worth of notes, you know, previous conversations they've had with the user, things like that. And then during the iteration kickoff meeting, we have the actual customer and user there, and they'll talk, the developer has have a chance to sort of grill this person about all the details they can think of. And those notes are captured interactively on the HTML page, on the wiki page as well.
Right.
And then the testers that afternoon, which is a Monday afternoon, will go to work then fleshing out what's started out as a set of bullet points with examples. So if the requirement is that when I open up the dialog to create a new note, that it lists all of the investors we currently know about in the system.
Okay.
That's the bullet point. The example test that goes along with that is click a new note button, check that the investor note dialog is that the note dialog box is open, and check that it contains these specific 50 investors with this spelling and this punctuation. And they'll write all that into the same HTML page so that by the time the developers finish implementing the code for the story, the test is fleshed out with data, and then it's a matter of writing the fixtures, which, depending on, in this case, we've architected the system such that the fixtures are very light and just involve a few lines of hookup code. That's the task. The story does not get checked off until it not only passes a, sort of a manual test by the testers, but then it passes all of these fitness tests as well. So what you end up with when a story gets checked off is the complete HTML page that contains all the requirements and all the tests, and that gets hooked into the cruise control build and runs with, you know, every subsequent check-in.
So this is an example where the thing that's being tested is really an interaction. It's a UI with an expected response.
Yes.
Right. The kinds of examples that I've heard, and you probably do some of this as well, are more along the lines of, this is the business logic for whatever the domain is, you know, loan processing, right? You know, there's this scenario, there's that scenario, the other scenario, right?
Right.
And so you can define a set of inputs, a set of rules, and a set of expected outcomes. Right, there's not necessarily, it's not an interactive. It's more checking of a declarative.
Sure.
Scenario, right? So,
and what we found is you can get at a lot of those business rules by the big question with FITS always been, where do I hook it in? Mm-hmm. Do I hook it in at my business tier and sort of bypass the UI and test all the UI by hand, or is if I try to hook it in at the HTML layer, you know, and I spend all my time trying to parse HTML.
Mm-hmm.
We found that a good place to hook in fitness is at the virtual UI layer, which is a sub-layer in the presentation layer just below the actual UI, and that you can do those kinds of business rule tests just as well, you know, expressing it in terms of the UI as you can expressing it in terms of inputs and outputs. And a lot of testers seem to be more comfortable the closer it is to their manual testing experience.
Right. Well, the concept of even having a virtual UI layer is an extremely interesting one with all sorts of ramifications, including the ability to express that UI in a variety of different presentation layers, right? So, I mean, that's a great concept. How do you make that happen?
How do you make that happen?
Yeah,
you make it important from the beginning. That was the big experiment with FHLB. Was, you know, if we were to focus on fitness tests from the beginning, what would it drive us to, both in terms of behaviors and in terms of system architecture? And this virtual UI was one of the things that popped out in terms of the architecture.
So, what do you mean by virtual UI?
So, take SWT for example.
Okay.
The way that I would might program let's take a simple dialog box where I can enter in some data and hit OK and it saves it in the system. The way that a typical architecture for that is the model view controller, where user gestures, you know, clicking on a button or selecting a value from a drop down or typing a character in a text box, those get passed off to the controller. And then the view gets updated by reading the model.
Mm-hmm.
What we do in a virtual UI layer is what essentially try to separate out the pixel painting code from all of the UI logic. So a simple example is the save button shouldn't be enabled until all of the all of the required fields are filled in with a valid value.
Okay. So this is within a domain, though, where you're assuming some kind of particular windowing environment, right, as opposed to something that's trying to abstract maybe the differences between.
Yeah, we haven't tried to create, you know, an abstract representation that you just haven't. Yeah, so you're right.
Which is a really hard but also a really interesting problem.
Yeah, but I would think that you might be able to. You got to start with a concrete example,
yep.
And I would think that you might be able to get to by starting with a single example of we're trying to create a virtual EI that mirrors how SWT works.
Right.
That could drive you, because essentially what you're doing with fitness is you're making fitness a second UI into the system.
Right. But so anyway, to get back to the sort of core of this idea, which is again I think really quite important. I mean, Ward told me that the aha moment for him with this was when it just occurred to him that the business people were doing all this scenario making in a spreadsheet, right, in Excel.
Right.
And I think the first iteration of this was simply that, right, to be able to hook up to the Excel spreadsheets, you know, where they had their, you know, their scenarios and their models.
Yeah.
To be able to hook up some sort of verification machinery that was actually connected to the software as it got built, right? Which, you know.
It's a very simple idea. This all the idea that I can express most of my tests in a tabular format, but it turns out to be very, very powerful.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things, we just had this discussion a half hour ago. One of the things it does is it forces the testers who may or may not be technical to separate the variable things from the non-variable things. Because what you're essentially saying is, you give me a test in a textual format, and I say, okay, take all the parts that if you're doing the same four steps with different data, take the step parts and make that the column headers, and then take the variable parts, which is the data,
mm-hmm.
and put those into your cells. So already enforcing a table structure is helping you know testers separate the commonality from the variation.
Yes. How do we make it so it's not all the developer's burden to bridge?
Yeah, well, let me just clarify a little bit with the FHLB example. The people that are writing the HTML pages are both analysts and testers, and customers as well.
Okay.
So it's not just the we consider, actually, in most of our XP projects, we consider the tester as not part of the technical team but part of the customer team.
Okay.
And so in many cases, they aren't that technically savvy, which is why the other tools we've tried, like XML-based tools or scripting tools, haven't worked as well.
Because they don't hide the XML sufficiently from folks and make
them. Like we've used a tool for quite extensively called Canoe Web Test, which lets you sort of script interaction with your web app
right.
using XML. And the thought was, well, anyone can learn to read and write XML,
right?
Which is kind of true, but not really. The actual writing and maintaining of a lot of XML is a skill that's beyond a lot of our, at least, business analysts and testers, and not something that they, you know, necessarily need to know to be good at their job. What they're good at is thinking up the. We found the business analysts are sort of good at thinking up the thinking big picture. How does this piece interact with the rest of the system? And when mm-hmm. I do this on this screen, what else should it affect? And then we found that testing people are very good at the exception, figuring out what all the bizarre exception cases are.
Right.
And so when you pair an analyst with a tester to write one of these fitness tests, you actually get quite a good combination.
And in both cases, these folks are writing in a wiki?
The teams we've worked with, yeah, we've had them use Fitness, which is
right.
A wiki. The reason for that is just it's the easiest way we found for a collaborative, to set up sort of a collaborative workspace.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can edit anytime, any web browser. Don't need a special tool.
Right, but you do need some shared understanding, since there's implied structure here that is what ends up driving the testing.
Exactly.
So people need to respect that, right? They need to they somehow need to understand and be able to comply with those implicit rules.
What that does is it forces the people writing the HTML test, the fitness test, to interact with the developers, because you've got to come up with a common way of naming things, for example.
Yeah.
If the developer is going to call this thing the note dialog and you're going to call it the investor note dialog, well, your test isn't going to run. And that's, I actually view that, again, as a benefit of it's, you know, just like we've tried to push the requirements people closer to the developers in terms of, you know, face-to-face, leveraging verbal face-to-face communication, mm-hmm. Do the same thing on the testing end. Don't make the test just be the job of the testers.
Yes.
Make everyone on the team, including the developers, responsible for writing, automating, and maintaining even the customer tests.
Right. So the idea being here, if you have this relatively fluid environment in which fundamentally what it does is enable that conversation to happen around what the shared vocabulary is going to be.
Exactly.
And that's really, in a sense, it's probably the best you can do. And
so yeah, it requires that interaction. And the testers often have better ideas for, or the analysts often have better ideas for names than the developers do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you mean this workgroup is a separate object? That's not a separate object. That's part of the larger investor search screen.
Right.
And you wouldn't have had that conversation before the analyst was trying to write a test.
Interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah, I've been. I think this. I'm putting my eggs in the fitness basket in terms of what I think holds a lot of promise. I think this idea of a human readable table based test. I think we've only begun to explore the power of how that can change the way business people interact with their IT teams. I have yet to see a business person, you know, bring up the fitness test every morning and click test just to see the green bar, but I wonder if someone somewhere isn't going to get hooked on that. I know how addictive it is for developers to get, you know, with the unit testing, this whole idea of, you know, I can push the button anytime, see my green bar.
Hey, everybody eventually wants a dashboard, right?
They
just need to see the right dials on their dashboard, the ones that make sense to them.
Well, it's Pavlovian too. I mean, it's funny how this happens. You know, you just get it really is an addiction. You know, if I can't run my tests every few minutes, I feel like something's missing.
Yeah.
The devil's in the details, Jeff said early in our conversation, and that's exactly right. I was particularly interested to hear about his company's use of FIT and fitness in collaboration with their customers. For more details on FIT, the framework for integrated test, go to fit.c2.com. And fitness, FITNESSE, the wiki that supports FIT, is at www.fitness.org. I'd like to thank Jeff for an interesting conversation, and I'll be back with another one whenever one happens.